Can't you just imagine Mary going to that tomb, thinking that she was going to anoint the one she loved so much, and then find him alive? Whew. That's what it means to experience, even 2,000 years later, what they experienced and truly see God. That's a beautiful, beautiful song. We're going to do something a little different tonight in some ways. Last week, you might remember that we talked about seeing God in our Bible study and the rebuke that Jesus gave to the scribes and Pharisees. And the words that are given, we have up on the screen here, when Jesus said to them, beginning in verse 37 of John 5, "And the Father who sent me has himself borne witness about me. His voice you have not heard, his form you have not seen." Just stop for 1 second there. Notice the beginning of that. He says, "My Father has borne witness about me." Now that would refer to what was written in the Old Testament, that these individuals claim to know so well. "My Father has borne witness about me. However, His voice you have not heard, his form you have not seen, and you do not have his word abiding in you, for you do not believe the one whom he has sent." The rebuke here is a rebuke to all of us in our lives in which we have read the scriptures, seen or have read the actual testimony of God about Jesus, and yet have not heard his voice or seen his form, and therefore have not had his word abiding in us. We want to learn how to read the scriptures in such a way, listen to the testimony of God in such a way, that we truly hear the voice of God, see his form, and then by that have his word abiding in us, and truly then believe in him. Hebrews chapter 2 is going to be the text that we're going to use as an example of how to see the form of God and hear the voice of God, and therefore have his word abiding in us. The text here in Hebrews 2, of course, has an important content for us, and I do not mean to minimize the content. We're going to look at it and try to see an example of how to read in such a way as to see the form of God and hear his voice. But the content is so relevant for us today. We have a situation in the book of Hebrews where these Hebrew Christians, as the writer said in chapter 10, are in need of endurance. They have been Christians probably longer than anyone else on the face of the earth at this time. And in that, they have grown weary. They have grown disappointed in what they had expected. And you can imagine how that would be, because you and I feel the same thing. Here are individuals who have had the confidence in the resurrection of Jesus, confidence in the fact that he's now reigning as king, and yet when they look around, they do not see the evidence with their own eyes. They do not see the evidence of the reigning Jesus. "I thought the kingdom had been established. I thought the conquering king had come." So what is going on when we look around at the world that we have today? I would suggest that we need the same thing. We need endurance. How many times, especially maybe in the last few years, have you become disappointed and suddenly realized our hope is not in the United States of America? Our hope is not in a political, earthly environment. It is not going to be the fulfillment of what we had hoped. And so we feel the same thing. What is the answer to this? What is the answer when we have become disappointed with what we are dealing with in this present life. And that is what Hebrews chapter 2 goes about showing us. I will notice with you, just as by way of introduction, that you will notice in the text that there are two worlds that the Hebrew writer introduces to us. In verse 5, he introduces to us the world to come. But when you look at verse 8, he refers to this present world. So at the present, there is something different than what is going to be in the world to come. At present, we do not see what the world to come is to have in store for us. In other words, when you read the words that is spoken of, when he says in verse 5, it was not to the angels that God subjected the world to come, but then it's been testified, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You've crowned him glory and honor and put everything in subjection under his feet. Well, you feel that? You walk around going, man, everything's in subjection under my feet. Why, we've got control of this world. Mankind is just really handling things wonderfully. No, we look at it and say, this is a mess. This is an absolute disaster area. I'm living in a disaster. And there's no remedy to it. And it can be to the point that our concentration and our sight has been looking at what is present instead of the picture of the world to come. So the Hebrew writer shows us in these beautiful pictures, and that's the thing that I think we miss the most when we study and do not study as is intended by the Lord. Study to see the beautiful paintings that God gives. He's painting pictures here. He is not just giving us some words of content. He is showing us in beautiful paintings of what we are to be able to see so that it encourages our hope and causes us to gain a tremendous excitement about what we're doing even in the midst of the mess. So that's doing that is not easy. I mean, doing it so that I can see the picture is not easy, especially because our tendencies and our habits have been to read the text and then just read the text. For example, when you may do a yearly Bible reading, the chances of seeing about 1/10 of the pictures is nigh on impossible, unless you have a fantastic memory of everything you read in the Old Testament. If you study a lesson book and there's questions given you, the chances of you seeing the beautiful pictures that are given are nearly impossible, because you may just simply being asked to repeat words in the text so that you're aware of what's there and you just have an observation of what's there. But you miss the beautiful painting that is given. I'm always reminded of Ed Harrell giving a lesson one time in which he had mentioned that he'd gone to an art museum the day before. And he said, I don't know a whole lot about those kinds of things. And I went through and we came out on the other side. And I looked at my friend and I said, boy, those folks sure can draw. Well, you know, that's just kind of the way it is. We can just look at something that is absolutely intended to be gorgeous and have no idea what we're looking at. Now, that'd be pretty well me. When Teresa tries to drag me into an art museum, I said, I'll give it a try. Here we go. But I would prefer having somebody next to me to say, this is what you're supposed to see in this beautiful painting. But that's what we should see with God. So our point here, then, in this text is to go through it, and I would like to use as an example so that you can see the painting. Get the message, but when you see the painting, the message will just explode for you. Obviously, it'll be important for you to have your Bible open so that you can see that actually in what we're going to read. All right, so from beginning to end, Hebrews is trying to show us the answer to the mess. The mess that was at present at that time, the mess that we are in today, and the world that we live in, here's the answer, Jesus. And he's going to show us this beautiful painting of how Jesus then is that answer. So notice beginning then in these verses we just read and was read for us this entire text. But you'll notice the words in verse 6 again. It has been testified somewhere, and then he gives the quotation from Psalm 8. Now please do not worry that the writer of Hebrews had no idea where Psalm 8 was. Well, that's not really the case. He is just saying, you know, exactly what the scripture has said. And he's telling us it's stated that. Now when you read those words, as we have already mentioned, you have crowned him in the end of verse 7 with glory and honor and putting everything under his feet. And then he goes on in verse 8, and he says, now in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. And by the time we get to that, we would say, I'm kind of puzzled, because I read David in Psalm 8 then saying that there's nothing out of his control and that he's given man glory and honor. He's crowned him. And does anyone feel that? And you say, no, I don't feel that. And he's left nothing outside. But then he comes to the rescue, and he goes on to say at the end of verse 8, at present we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. I am so glad he said that, because otherwise I would have been scratching my head trying to figure out how in the world that mankind has been crowned with glory and honor and everything is under his control. What adds to this idea is when we read that passage from Psalm 8, we're immediately aware of Genesis 1, aren't we? So we think, well, yes, the Lord made man in his own image, and he put all the world and everything that he made in subjection to him. And have you ever read that and kind of went, that's really? He did? We're not doing a very good job of that, and we have that same feeling there. And then the Hebrew writer to the rescue. Well, actually, those were things that God had put all under his control, but man in fracturing this was going to need some help. So we do not see it at present the way it is intended to be. Verse 9, but we see him. We see Jesus. And so he goes on to say, we don't see this happening at the present, but we should be looking at the world to come. Because verse 5 said, This is something that he put in subjection to man, but is not yet happened. It is in the world to come. And why is it in the world to come? Because we have forgotten that Jesus has another part to his work. His work is not done. We know this from how many times that Peter and others quoted passages. He reigns until all enemies are put under his feet. Well, why didn't I think of that in the first place? He's reigning until all, which means the enemies are still in existence, which means everything is not yet in subjection to man, which means that we need to look forward to that world to come that will be put in subjection to us. And so verse 5 reminds us of where our eyes are to be, not in the mess of the present, but in the world to come under which that which will be in subjection to us. And so in verse 9, when you see those words, for we see him for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that the grace of God might be made. By the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. Now, you immediately read those words and you say, aha, those are the same words that we read in Psalm 8. Those are the same words that he quoted. He just got through saying that man was going to be, was created to have glory and honor and be crowned, and man was going to have all things in subjection under his feet. But since we don't see that, happening, what do we see? Well, we see Jesus who was crowned with glory and honor. We see Jesus who does have all things in subjection under his feet. We go, well, that's great. And then he goes on that he shows us how he got there. He got there because of the suffering of death. Now, there's two aspects of that we need to notice. First, he got there because of death. He had to go through death to be placed in control and all things in subjection to him, and he'd be crowned with glory and honor. Death was the passage by which he had to go to get to that particular point. There's another word, suffering. Suffering was necessary in order to get to that point in which he's crowned with glory and honor. That is the idea of the text. And why is that? Because the only reason we do not enjoy all things in subjection to us, the reason we have not been crowned with glory and honor, is because of the threat of death. Death is going to destroy that. Death, because of sin, is going to destroy that. We have not yet passed through the journey that he is taking us. He has gone there, and now he is asking us to follow him in that particular journey. In the meantime, you remember the Hebrew Christians, and very often us, get quite discouraged, not happy with what's going on here. In that discouragement, there's frustration, there's anxiety, there's troubling, there's anger, there's a lack of peace. And sometimes it's not long before we even turn on each other because it's just not what it ought to be. And why aren't you living where it ought to be? And they, you know, we're turning back, well, yeah, but you're not. And we're going, yeah. And so what does Jesus do? Notice how he begins verse 10. For it was fitting that he for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. Now, there's a mouthful, but he is really showing what he's doing. Now, first thing I want you to notice is the beginning statement. Notice how he says, it was fitting that he for whom and by all things exist. All things exist for who? Jesus. And all things exist because he brought them all into existence. He is definitely making a reference back to chapter 1 and verse 2, where he shows us that he was appointed heir of all things through whom he created the world. He's the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature. He upholds the whole universe by the word of his power. Here is the one who, when he created, not only is the reason everything exists, but he is He caused everything to exist for himself. And what is he doing with it? You say, well, what? What a mess. No. This is the one who, in bringing many sons to glory, that's what he's doing. He is doing something that brings many sons to glory. Now, obviously, if you were reading this in the Hebrew, this would be sons and daughters. This would be an inclusive kinds of things. I hate to sometimes read a text in the present day and have sometimes women going, is he talking about just the guys? No, there's the picture that is used throughout Scripture, and most of you understand that. But he was bringing many sons to glory. In the end of verse 10, should make the founder, this is what God is doing, he made the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. He's the perfect founder. If you're reading other translations, you might see the word pioneer or trailblazer. Chip mentioned this Wednesday night. He's the trailblazer. He's the pioneer. How many, you know, when you read about American history and you go back and learn about the explorations and Lewis and Clark expeditions and things like that, you're looking at pioneers. You're looking at those who went and cut the way and a path to go beyond what was even known. at that time. And that's what Jesus has done. He's the trailblazer. He's bringing us through. He's the founder of our salvation, the trailblazer, bringing us through suffering. Then he hits down on that hard point. There's only one way to get there, and it's through suffering. But where are we going now? Back in verse 5? In verse 5, we are headed for that point in which the world is in subjection to us, where the mess is taken care of. And now we have come to be crowned with glory and honor. That's where we're going. And then, of course, we're reminded a little bit of the Old Testament picture, which he will talk about in chapter 3, of Israel going through the wilderness to the promised land. Does that sound familiar? Yes, that's what this is. And if I can keep looking at the world to come and looking at my pioneer and following him, I realize that this is the path that has to be taken. Okay, so those are words. Those are instructive words. Those were set up by an introduction from Psalm 8. But now he needs to go beyond that, and in order to do so, he wants to show us and paint us a picture. And this is where we come to the point where we get a picture and view of God himself. And so you see in verse 11, "For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source." Some versions, all are just one, or all are one family. That is why he's not ashamed to call them brothers, and then he's going to give a quotation. But first, I want you to notice those words. He who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all one. What's sanctified? You know, this modern day, we probably read those words, I know I do, and kind of go, huh? He sanctifies and we're sanctified. Well, let's read it a little differently, and let's read it just the way the Greek and the Hebrew would use these particular words. It is just simply comes from the word and is the root of the word holy. He who makes holy and those who are holy are one. That is why he's not ashamed to call us brothers. Now that's an important point, isn't it? He's not ashamed to call us brothers because by sanctifying us, by making us holy, and then us being holy and living holy, he's brought us into one family so that we are brothers. I'm not ashamed to own you and say you're in my family. Some of you may be in a family in which you say, you know, I hope a particular relative isn't at the family reunion. You are ashamed to call them family because they're not living in a way that respects the family name. And that's what Jesus is saying the opposite of. I'm not ashamed to call you brothers. I've made you holy and you're living holy. Over in chapter 12 and verse 14, he said, "Without holiness, we will not see the Lord." That is critical. In Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 4, he said, "He chose us before the foundation of the world that we might be holy and blameless." Now that is a motivation, isn't it? That is a motivation for how you and I are going to live during the week. That's a motivation to maintain our holiness so that he's not ashamed to call us brothers. Don't go back into that other stuff. Holiness is critical to him then saying, you're in the family. And you're acting like the family. And I made you part of the family. And the way I made you the part of the family is by making you holy and bringing you then through with that holiness as my children, as my brothers, as my family members. The typical aspiration of even Christians, if not the world, of course, in general, is material gain and the time that we would like to have in order to enjoy that material gain. That's the aspiration of the world. And unfortunately, sometimes even Christians. But he's pointing out here that the greatest aspiration, the primary aspiration, is growth in holiness. That's what we are to be, is the reason that he's not ashamed. Now we come to the actual picture. And he says, he's not ashamed to call us brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. Now, what is the tendency when we're reading through a text? And we see that simple little line, I will tell your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I'll sing your praise. And we say to ourselves, as I have often done, and we say to ourselves, well, verse 11 says that he's made us one and he's not ashamed to call us brothers. And there's some verse somewhere, somehow, in the Old Testament that says, I will tell your name among my brothers. And we kind of go, okay, I see the word brothers that came from an Old Testament text, and I see that word brothers, and I guess the Old Testament foretold the time when Jesus and his family members, his offspring, would be considered brothers, and I'd be a brother of Jesus. That's nice. Let me go on. And when we do not see the form of God nor hear his voice. Did we actually expect that the Hebrew writer would stop and quote for us the entire 22nd Psalm so that we could see the picture? Absolutely not, because then Hebrews would be quite large. It would, fill up probably a good third of the Old Testament, and we'd say, boy, Hebrews is a big book. So instead, he quotes one little verse and expects us to go back and find the story that is being given. So if you will look for just a quick moment, hold your place in Hebrews, and go to Psalm 22, and we will see the actual context of this particular little statement that he has quoted here. Now, most of you probably recognize the beginning of Psalm 22, in which is quoted by Jesus in the New Testament. Verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? And the psalmist David here does something that he does in numerous of his psalms. This is not the only time he does this. He goes through and he talks about how that God has always delivered him and cannot understand why God at this moment has not come to his deliverance. He's pleaded and he's pleaded, and the things are getting urgent, and they're getting even more urgent. And it's getting so urgent that he begins to really scream to God, you have to deliver me. It's almost here. I'm almost going to be crushed. Please come to my help. Save me, verse 21 says, from the mouth of the lion. And then suddenly, the reversal. You have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen. And now our quote, verse 22. I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. Notice how David now turns and becomes an evangelist. That's David. He's a great evangelist. And he turns and he begins to evangelize, tell the good news about God and how God is truly a rescuer. That even when a time when you could not imagine that he was going to rescue, when you came to your depths, God was going to be there, and he did rescue. So you who fear the Lord, praise him. I'm going to tell of your name to my brothers, to the whole congregation. I'm going to tell of your name. And then, verse 23, you who fear the Lord, praise him. All you offspring of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him, all you offspring of Israel. For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. And he has not hidden his face from him, but has heard when he cried to him. What did you say in verse 1, David? My God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you? Why don't you hear my words? But then he sees the rescue and he tells of his name to his brothers and he turns and he says, he hasn't hidden his face. In fact, he has heard when he cried to him. Now, Why does the psalmist quote this? Here are the Hebrew Christians, and they are suffering and been going through tribulation, as chapter 10 says. They have been dealing with this. They are losing hope. They need endurance. And so the Hebrew writer quotes Psalm 22, which would be quite evident to not only be a Psalm of David, but to be a messianic psalm. And he says, look what happened with the Messiah. Yes, there was a point in which it seemed hopeless. And he's crying that God will deliver. And just about the time he had given up hope, when the tribulation was as deep as it could be, God came to the rescue. And he goes on even in the psalm to say God would rescue even those who could not keep their life, their physical life, keep themselves from dying. Now, if you're a Hebrew and you're reading this and you're saying he's calling us brothers and then quote Psalm 22, what's the message that should be given? The message then is clear that just as God came to the rescue of Jesus and would never turn his face away from him, and just as God came to the rescue of David and would never turn his face away from the faithful, he would never turn his face away from any of his people. They are brothers. And if your brother Jesus was rescued by God in the midst of tribulation and suffering, he will also rescue you because he's called you brothers. And suddenly, in the midst of suffering and tribulation, and when you're feeling it at the worst, and when you're the lowest, you can turn and you can read Hebrews 2 and say, wow, Jesus is my brother. We all have one source. We're all in one family. And I do not have to worry about whether he's going to rescue. He will rescue, even though at the moment it feels like I'm not getting an answer. But he hasn't forsaken me and will never forsake me. That's the importance of seeing the picture that's being given. And we could, of course, spend a lot more time even in Psalm 22 to make sure we saw that. But you see that point there as he paints that beautifully. But then immediately before he gets done with the painting, he turns around in verse 13 and he says, and again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. Again, we read those words and we say, well, okay, doesn't seem to be very important to me. Why don't I just go on to verse 14? And yet, what we need to understand is that he has made a quotation from Isaiah chapter 8, verse 17 and 18. You say, well, what's that? Well, that's a text that is a culmination of two previous chapters. And going even further to that, from Isaiah chapter 7 all the way through Isaiah chapter 9. And so you say, well, what am I going to need to know to understand the quotation that's given here? You're going to have to at least know Isaiah chapter 7 and Isaiah chapter 8 and maybe even to chapter 9 to understand what's happening. We do not have time tonight for me to read that to you, but let me give you a summation very quickly. In Isaiah 7, that is the famous passage where Ahaz, that wicked king Ahaz, was in a situation in which he was fearful of Syria having a conspiracy or a covenant with the northern kingdom of Israel. And the two of them had banded together and were coming to attack and destroy Judah. Ahaz was so fearful that he was making all kinds of preparations. He's on the phone to Egypt. He's on the phone to Assyria, trying to find somebody who will come and save him from the attack of Syria and Israel. And God goes to Ahaz and he says, don't worry about those two firebrands. They're nothing. He says, I'm going to destroy them. You're never going to see them at your gates. You don't have to worry about them. In fact, ask me a sign. Ask me a sign and I'll give you a sign that will prove to you that they're never going to attack you. Ask me a sign. In fact, ask me a sign that is higher than heaven and lower than Sheol. Just ask me anything and I'll do it. What a cool thing if God said that to you. and Ahaz, the rebellious, wicked king. I wouldn't ask the Lord of a sign. And the Lord, in anger, says, well, then I'll show you a sign. A young woman will be with child and bear a son. And before that son is old enough to even say mommy and daddy, those two nations are going to be long gone. And so you might remember that Isaiah had already had one son, Shear-Jashub, which meant the remnant. There'll be a remnant that will return, but only a remnant. And then in chapter 8, in answer to God's sign, or the fulfillment of God's sign, Isaiah's wife has a second son. My favorite guy, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. And I keep waiting for a woman to name their son Maher Shalal Hashbaz. I kind of doubt you might, but you could have all kinds of shortened names for him. So here is Maher Shalal Hashbaz, which simply means that God is going to destroy those two nations. You don't have to worry about what's going to happen. The spoil speeds and the prey hastens. God is going to come and destroy those two nations, and there's not going to be anything left of them. He gave them that sign. Now, you are aware that Isaiah 7 verse 14 is quoted by Matthew in chapter 1 of Matthew. A virgin shall conceive and be with child, and they shall call his name, what? Emmanuel, God with us. What does the birth of those children to Isaiah mean? God with us. In fact, he uses the term back there, Emmanuel, in chapter 8. God's going to be Emmanuel for you. He's going to be with you, even in the midst of the depth of suffering, even in the midst of what it looks like you're going to be destroyed by Israel and Syria, even in the midst of absolute hopelessness. Remember, here are two kids whose names are prophetic names that gives you hope. God is with you. Shear-Jashub, a remnant is going to return. Only a remnant, but there is hope. A remnant's going to return. Maher Shalal Hashbaz, the spoil speeds. He's going to destroy them. These two kids are evidence that God is with you and going to get you through this suffering and going to bring you to the other side and give you hope. That's what this is about. And then Jesus becomes the ultimate fulfillment. An actual virgin, not the exact word of Isaiah, but an actual virgin will be the sign. And this virgin will give birth, and this virgin will have a child. And that child, according to Isaiah chapter 53, will die going through suffering. And when he dies and raises from the dead, Isaiah 53:10, he will produce children. Oh. And those children will then be a sign to the world, just like the children of Isaiah were a sign to Israel that God would never desert them and bring a remnant through, and that he was going to destroy the enemy. And now Jesus then is born of a virgin, the greatest sign, and he produces children. And we then, as his children, are then those who are object lessons to the world. So Isaiah had said in the quotation of Isaiah chapter 8, verse 17 and 18, I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will hope in him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. Just as God had given Isaiah children as a sign of God's presence, that God would always be with them. He would never desert them. So now Jesus has come along, born of a virgin, and produced offspring, sending us out into the world, giving the world a similar hope. A hope that they also can be delivered from the mess that this world is in. Be delivered because we now are signs of life from the dead. When everything looked bad, Jesus was born of a virgin. When everything looked bad, when Jesus was killed and it looked like it was over, as we sang with the song of Mary Magdalene, the answer was that Jesus was always there and God was always there. And the producing of an offspring brings us to that. He becomes then our trailblazer, and he concludes it then with those words in verses 14 through 18. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself also partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Now just consider. Look to Jesus. That's where he started. Look to Jesus. Here's the picture. What did he do? He shared in the same flesh and blood you and I did. And in sharing in that same flesh and blood, he delivered all of those who suffered from the fear of death all their life. I have to say, there's a little question. We need to do a better job of acting like we're not afraid of death. We need to do a better job of responding to the threat of death. Because you see, on the other side of death is crowned with glory and honor and the world to come in subjection to us. We lose nothing. We think of sickness and illness and death or tribulation and persecution and threats by a government or whatever. We look at it as a loss. How many years I read the life of Paul, the apostle, and how many great things he's doing, and then suddenly he's arrested, and you can just feel it when he's traveling toward Jerusalem and he's getting the visions, and the prophets are saying, "Don't go, don't go, don't go." And Paul is going, "Will you just be quiet?" You know why they're saying it. "No, Paul. You're going to lose out on all that great work you can do. You're the best. You're our home run hitter. You're the one who goes through the empire and sets up churches. If you're not out there, it is great loss." It is not loss. To live is Christ. To die is gain. There was no loss. In fact, more of the world heard the gospel when Paul was put in prison. I'm afraid that without knowing that, I would have been in prison mumbling and grumbling about how many things I could be doing that I'm not getting to do. But that's what the Hebrew writer is saying. There is no loss here. And when the time comes in which you are suffering, there is no loss here. The loss is only, well, what could I could be doing this or I could be doing that. I could be filling some kind of bucket list that I'd like to do. None of those things are a loss, because what is about to happen is that you are going to be crowned with glory and honor, and the world to come is being subjection to you. What kind of bucket list is going to meet up with that? No. There is that great picture. And so the writer then says, look at this. There's no fear then of death. You've been living a lifelong slavery that you need to let go of. And then in verse verse 16, for surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. That's us. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the servants of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted. We're tempted here, by the way. Not just tempted to sin, trial, tribulation, challenges, difficulty, hardships, suffering. When he went through that, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Now you put that all together and you have this gorgeous picture. The picture of when he suffered. God did not desert him and didn't turn his face away, and he calls us brothers, and he's not going to do it to us either. The picture of when the nation of Israel was at its lowest and they were being threatened and they were going to be destroyed. And God says, don't worry, I'm going to bring back a remnant. And the children that are being born here are a sign. And then he gave a child through the virgin who produced us as his offspring, who now are able to be signs to the world that God has not deserted and that he will bring us through suffering. And then for us individually, every single moment of our lives, as we deal with various tribulations, suffering, as we deal with the mess that we look in, as we deal with political upheaval, as the past few years have gone on, I'm always reminded of the book of Revelation that talks about what came out of the sea in Revelation? A beast. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, last verse of Revelation 12, and in chapter 13 he called a beast up out of the sea. And the beast becomes the Roman Empire who persecutes and tries to destroy Christians. And God destroys the beast eventually. And the kingdom of God lives on forever and ever. A sign to the world that God will never desert you. So when you think of the upheaval, think of the ocean. It's always spewing things up. It's pretty. But it's always changing the shoreline. It's always spewing things up. It's always throwing things out. And up out of that upheaval, that's politics. Up out of that upheaval comes beasts. We don't have to worry about that. Because on the other side, we're crowned with glory and honor. And all things of the world to come will be in subjection to us. So did you hear the voice of God? And did you see his form? By studying in this way, where you're looking at God's painted pictures, he's not only telling you what he's going to do, he's also giving you a beautiful painting that will cause you to have hope from that time on, so that you're always thinking of the painting of the beautiful things that you saw, and you saw the form of God. That's who he is, one who will never desert you and never leave you. If you're not a Christian, or if you are obviously interested in studying more, please let one of us know. We'd be glad to help you in any way that we can. And if you're someone who already knows what you need to do to come to Christ and you're ready to make that step, we hope that you will do so, that you can stand as the children of God who are signs to the world of God's great salvation. Any way we can help you, please come. While together we stand while we sing.